If we look presently at the FBI and its operations directed at Arabs, Muslims, and Southeast Asians, whom it deemed to be enemies of the state, we could see similarities between what took place in the 1960s and what is taking place presently. The targets at this point are Arabs, Muslims, and Southeast Asian population. With all its subgroups, subdivisions, ethnic groupings, theological orientations, and levels of political involvement. When we saw the counterintelligence operations directed at African Americans in the 1960s, it didn't matter what kind of organization you belonged to, it was all organizations were included. And as such, when we look at the Arabs, Muslims, and Southeast Asians, all subgroups, subdivisions, sub-ethnic groupings, immigrant or indigenous, ideological differentiations, all are included as targets by the new COINTELPRO operations. In his book, War at Home, Brian Glick identifies the four major methods used by the FBI in the 1960s. One, infiltration. Second, psychological warfare from outside. Third, harassment through the legal system. Fourth, extra-legal force and violence employed by the FBI during the height of the COINTELPRO program. And if we superimpose them on the current period, we can begin to possibly explain the security structures deployed against Muslims and their allies. Taking the issue of infiltration first. Muslim communities globally are subject to a massive infiltration campaign, and the same goal is pursued domestically inside the United States. Now, some of the elements that had interest at present at infiltration, and we have information about infiltration campaigns, the Christian coalition members for their own benefits, pro-Israel forces in this country, Arab security services, Arab and Muslim through sectarian divide also involved, and FBI newly hired agents. The problem confronting the Department of Homeland Security today is how to gain access to a closed religious community that has been identified as the new enemy that the country must be defended against and its possible future attacks. And here we are concerned with identifying the active thinking of those who are designing and implementing a new infiltration program directed at Muslim communities in America. Abroad, meaning the Muslim world, the ability to infiltrate is much easier since each nation state has a fully functioning intelligence service that has its hands in every organization. But the situation in the United States is completely different. It might be the case that the U.S. security services would work to employ agents from external sources in the hope that they might have a greater possibility in infiltration than their own domestic assets. No hard evidence of this is available, but one cannot rule out such a theory, considering the levels of cooperation between the various agencies on an international level. My hypothesis is that the FBI has been engaged in a massive recruitment campaign directed at members of the Arab, Muslim, and Southeast Asian communities. Such an effort follows an all-proven tactic of the carrot-and-stick approach. In some cases, the recruitment is undertaken by means of a very sweet-tasting carrot in the form of money, position, prestige, and the allure of the world. However, at times, the best tool for recruitment is a very long and mighty stick, which produces result, but the first method is often preferable, since it originates in an inherent weakness in the individual that makes them want to cooperate to secure a benefit they have been after for some time. The second method is less foul-proof, since the individual has resistance to a carrot offer, and only after reaching a possible breaking point, he or she were ready to cooperate and become employed by the security agencies. In my estimation, the period of recruitment was put in place immediately after 9/11, and it's still underway 3 years removed from the tragic events. I don't know the number of those to be recruited, but it would take a large investment in human agents to infiltrate a 6 to 10 million member community with all its subgroups and nationalities. One group that has been offering its services for its own ideological reasons is the Israel-centric members of the American society. A number of existing outfits have been at work targeting Muslim organizations and individuals for the benefit of securing Israel's political and economic interest in America. Many Israeli-centric individuals and organizations view with great alarm the increase in number and assertiveness of the American Muslim and Arab communities, since it has the potential in the long run of causing a reconsideration of existing policies vis-a-vis the Middle East and Israel. The infiltration program directed by the Israel-centric grouping has longer experience in this field and are also able to recruit from a diverse pool of personnel that speaks Arabic and serve possibly in some capacity in the occupied territories. I'm pointing this out so we are able to understand the range of possibilities deployed in this current security project. However, the Israel-centric recruits might always be ready to oversell the threat, and the information collected is highly tainted, since the goal of the operations they are involved in is connected to foreign countries' interests first, and then the domestic security consideration second. Now, when we speak of some of the Israel-centric individuals, we could say that Front Page magazine is one of those Israel-centric. Canvas Watch of Daniel Pipes is such an outfit. The ADL, for a long period of time, has been engaged in collection of information as well. So we have a number of these private agencies connected to the Israel-centric grouping that is engaged in systematic collection of information. A similar condition also would be found among the agents borrowed from Arab and Muslim countries. But a slight difference exists in that the information collected by such individuals are always re-examined due to a lack of a trust in whatever is produced by, quote, a third world personnel, an issue not considered when it comes to Israel materials altogether. So we also have a racist structure operating at the collection of intelligence information. Intelligence collected by what we perceive to be a Western-oriented community or society has a higher value than intelligence collected by what we perceive to be third world countries, that their work has to be rechecked and re-examined. During the 1960s, the infiltration was not limited to a basic spy and report operation. On the contrary, the enterprise purpose was to discredit and disrupt the activities of targeted individuals and organizations. At times, it was very difficult to identify who was actually responsible for what activities, considering the heavy involvement of the FBI agent in undercover operations across the political spectrum. If we consider this fact, then we can rest assured that the Department of Homeland Security and the FBI arm has reached the upper limits in the recruitment campaign. And every major Arab, Muslim, and Southeast Asian organization or center must have someone already on the job collecting information for Big Brother. The discredit and disrupt phase has just started, and rest assured that it will kick into high gear in the next few years, considering the personnel that has been arrayed by the Bush administration for his second term. On the issue of recruitment, a painful fact has to be brought to everyone's attention, which had to do with the cooperation of the targeted communities in the recruitment campaign itself. In August 2002, and during my attendance of the 39th Annual Islamic Society of North America National Convention in Washington, D.C., the largest Muslim gathering in the country, having almost 40,000 attending, one information booth caught my eyes more than the other 1,000 or so in the bazaar and the lobby area. It was a fully decked FBI recruitment table. We are in a period full of fear, and one way to demonstrate that we are good is through opening our doors and arms to the FBI. Some during the convention We're saying to the FBI that we don't have anything to hide and you can come to any and all of our centers, events, schools, and conferences to see for yourself. And that they did. I can understand the logic behind such PR with government agencies. Since the saying we are citizens and they are part of our government, then it would be okay for us to invite them to our convention in order to open lines of communication. In addition, almost every mosque and community center have had some type of a get-together with their local FBI office director under the premise that we are ready to cooperate. Now, some of these meetings did focus on hate crimes directed at the Arabs, Muslims, and Southeast Asian communities, which can be viewed as legitimate, but isolated crimes should be the least of our concern, since the campaign against the targeted communities is carried out through the top leadership of the FBI and the Homeland Security itself. Meaning that vigilante or hate crimes against Arabs and Muslims are isolated incidents compared to the whole operating structure of hate fomented by government agents and government agencies itself. And therefore, inviting the FBI into the community and into these events was a miscalculation by the community itself. The communities, in seeking to cast themselves in a positive light, facilitated the recruitment process and possibly made it more successful than if the FBI was left to its own fumbling devices. Not to imply that the Muslims were the only ones to do so in their national convention. Another organization, the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, likewise had an FBI cable prominent in their annual meeting in Washington, D.C., and was seen by some in the convention as a major sign of our inclusion into the fabric of America. What we see here is the mixing of assimilation politics with civil rights advocacy by an immigrant population. Both of these elements are intrinsic to the mission of many national organizations, and the lack of specialization mixed with a rather weak structure leads to critical and unforgivable lapses of judgment. Likewise, the Council on Islamic Relations on the national and regional levels embarked on hosting community meetings with the local FBI officers as a way to provide information to an already fearful Muslim public, and at the same time open channels of communication with the powerful agency. My feelings and critiques of these initiatives is not directed at undermining the work that has been done by so many people in all those organizations who often operated under the gun in attempting to mount a defense of the community at a moment of crisis. The missions of the organization mentioned above are inspiring, and this critique should, if understood correctly, help redirect the effort into a more appropriate avenues. Through the many meetings held by the targeted communities with the FBI in mosques, churches, and community organizations, the agency has been able to recruit the needed personnel for its ongoing new COINTELPRO project. The community was or is afraid, the argument went, and a way to make people feel safe is to bring in the agents of the FBI or their public relations officers to speak to people and offer them help and support. Yes, the community faced a number of hate crimes attacks, and the FBI was involved in providing protection. But these invitations, at least in my own estimation, were not intended with this aspect in mind. On the contrary, the key motivation was to demonstrate our readiness to cooperate with the FBI and other security agencies. Definition and opposition, and a vanguard to the excesses of existing power structure. You might ask, why an opposition? One must be reminded that it is the nature of power to seek restrictions and legislative limitation on liberties of citizens, which means civil rights organizations are the antithesis to power in well-developed civil societies. When civil rights organizations are preoccupied with assimilation, then the outcome of such an approach would lead to compromising fundamental rights for the benefit of access and representation. Also, the access and representation sought to the power structure is often is often dependent upon services rendered to the power structure from such an encounter. How to infiltrate a relatively closed religious community? This was done through a systematic approach that uses existing community organizations and leverage their state of fear and insecurity to produce openings that can be capitalized upon by the security agencies. I would expect at this point that the Department of Homeland Security and the FBI have already developed a database which contains the names of every local, regional, and national leader in the Arab, Muslim, and Southeast Asian communities. In addition, the database will contain names of individuals who are more than happy and ready to offer their services for the agency at a discounted rate or no fee at all. Infiltration is underway under the premise of securing America from sleeper cells. I wish that we could catch some of the ones that are sleeping. Operating among law-abiding Muslim citizens, and no one should have anything to fear from these operations, the FBI says. Events of 9/11 are used as the benchmark to mollify and silence opposing voices. It should not come as a surprise that the Arab, Muslims, and Southeast Asian communities are divided on a myriad of issues, including that of nationality, language group, worldview, level of religiosity, and class, to point just the obvious. From the FBI perspective, this condition provides ample inroads into this insular community, and if we add to it large number of immigrants settled in this country after failed covert operations, then the scope of infiltration becomes more readily attainable. The goals of the infiltration has not changed much since the FBI and the U.S. security agencies look back at COINTELPRO as a success model, even though it has been discredited afterward. So the U.S. security and intelligence institution, they look at COINTELPRO as a success model, and their response is, do you see any of these organizations still around challenging the status quo? So why we might look out and say, well, the system or the structure have adjusted and corrected itself, the reality is they see it as a success model. The measurement of success is the complete elimination of the radical movements of the 1960s and early 70s, and their replacement by political forces that were more ready to acquiesce to security agencies' program rather than maintain a mode of resistance. So the resistance of the 1960s was eliminated, and by the time we get to the 70s, it was already gone. The conditions are ripe for the institution of a similar project directed at the new enemy of the state. It is far too early to tell what shapes or direction the infiltration will take, but if you use the 60s cookbook, then we can contemplate some possible operations. For example, immigrant Muslim communities in the U.S. and convert communities are overwhelmingly peaceful and rarely consider violence as an option for bringing about political changes in America. This is just a reading of the community. The reasons for this are based on the makeup, the reasons of immigration, and the level of economic well-being among members of the community. One aspect of the infiltration goal might be to create, encourage, an inclination toward violence among some members of the community, which could be used to justify greater security measures taken against the targeted communities. You might say that this is a fabricated thought and reeks the smell of conspiracy thinking in the author. Yes and no. Conspiracies do exist, but the case above is not one of them, since it is based on abundance of evidence of FBI use of such methods domestically, and we could say that the CIA made it into a science on the international arena. If any of the Muslim communities in the United States takes violence as a method and they are located within the urban centers, then spend the time in finding out who is within the group and rest assured that the security agency's footprints would not be far from that person. This is not a discussion of violence or non-violence in the movement, a question that can be raised by any short-sighted individual considering what I'm saying at this particular time. And this is not a condemnation or supporting of one view or the other, violence or non-violence. Violence as a tactic in urban centers has no possibility of success. And the long history of revolutions and guerrilla movement is offered as evidence for you. Among the many elements for guerrilla movement success is not being stationary and not open to being contained in a defined territory that is easily controlled by its opposition. Thus, Muslim communities in the United States are all urban, lack connection to the rural areas, and barely can survive few days without stop at the local 7-Eleven or Safeway stores, and can barely live without a latte and a coffee house, hopefully not from Starbucks. And the security agencies know this and understand its meaning if violence is pursued by the Muslim community. Ironically, the only group in the United States that is readily equipped and able to engage in guerrilla warfare in this country are the white militias. Because they're not urban, they're connected to the land, they have freedom of maneuverability and operation, and they have a strong support among the communities they are in. The events of 9/11 were carried out by an outsider Muslim group that had no real connection to the existing Muslim communities. But guilt by association defines all by the wrong actions of the few. The primary goal of the infiltration program is to discredit and disrupt the operation of the enemies of the state, which in this case, once again, are Arabs, Muslims, and Southeast Asians. And here we must be clear that the security structure's attempt at discrediting and disrupting the enemy is intertwined with the primary goals of the pro-Zionist, pro-Israel forces, who have made an immediate link between the larger war on terrorism and their ongoing campaign against the Palestinians. As such, the infiltration program has a twofold goal. One, directed at those who might express support to bin Laden, and second, which is more important these days, focusing on pro-Palestinian sentiment among the targeted communities. Both goals cannot be achieved without a systematic infiltration campaign, a tentative to a successful discrediting and disruption program. When we are looking at all the cases that emerged after 9/11, the overwhelming majority of cases that we are confronting have to do more with the Palestine issue rather than Osama bin Laden in the U.S., which in here that many of the pro-Israel activists have been constantly at work making that link and thus discrediting pro-Palestinian activists who are speaking out on Palestine. In dealing with religious movements, the discrediting campaign involves far more than a simple spy on the inside. Rather, the intent of a such program is discrediting of the ideology, supposedly, that gives rise to it. What this means for the infiltration program is possibly the encouragement of counter-movements that cause a clash of ideology. However, the security structure making sure that they are working with the alternative ideology camp, which might have a number of names in the near future. In order to discredit bin Laden's ideology, the infiltration campaign would need to develop an antithesis paradigm and develop support for it as a way to win the war. Here I'm speaking of the bin Laden's ideology in reference to Muslim communities in America, which might be a little odd since I already argued the lack of any direct links with him. But the reference point in here is the perception that has already been developed by the government that underlies the security structure's thinking, which views the Arabs, Muslims, and Southeast Asians as extended pockets of ideological support and affinity to Al-Qaeda. And here the affinity is the affinity with ideological positions, meaning opposing U.S. intervention and presence in the Middle East, opposing continuous U.S. support to Israel, continued expansion of U.S. power at the expense of Arab and Muslims and Southeast Asians. If such pockets exist, then it is easy for it to be transformed into active networks. Thus, the infiltration program is warranted, if not demanded, to prevent such an eventuality from the point of view of the homeland security. And here, the Homeland Security and the FBI would have to engage in ideological discrediting and disruption for the campaign to have much of a success, which is something that was also used in the 60s. You have a whole number of communist and leftist organizations that the FBI was actually creating as a way of trying to neutralize the effective or real organizations, labor as well as civil rights. At this point, I will not contemplate on the methods that will be deployed by the agencies to accomplish this ideological task, but I direct individuals to follow this project by paying extra attention to the wider debates involving Islam in the world and what initiatives are supported and which ones are fought. A final note on infiltration. Some with ill intent will take what I'm saying above as a sign of support for, quote-unquote, the terrorists, since I'm pointing out the campaign being carried out against them, which would only help those who are enemies of this country, a logic that's often been used in the past. Contrary to such ill-intent individuals, who are many these days, the reason for what I'm saying is to bring awareness to what is possibly an already existing policy directed at communities that have committed no crimes whatsoever and done nothing wrong in this country. As to supporting quote-unquote terrorists, which is often levied at anyone who critiques the Bush administration, I recommend for anyone making such an argument to look no further than those with power and influence in our society, who provided training and money, support, when they issued the subcontract for the Afghan war against the Russians. Also, if anyone is speaking about possibly terrorism in relations to Iraq, if anyone wants evidence, look no further than Donald Rumsfeld with his meetings of Saddam Hussein in the 1980s. What makes the same person acceptable to our country one day and despise the next? Actually, we call it the national interest. Second, major tool employed during the height of the COINTELPRO operation was psychological warfare from outside at the targeted group. This is very easy to deal with at this time, considering the 24/7 negative attention directed at Muslims, Arabs, and Southeast Asians in the mainstream media. I'm not one who considers all media to be evil, even though we could have much evidence to say so, but Satan is not one of their agents. But do understand that some have agendas while others are connected to certain ideological camp and are ready to employ their pen, voice, or image to the empire's project at home. The pressure to keep a job and have a steady check to pay for costs of living prevents many from taking on the empire and its many embedded executives and high up. The constant barrage of negative stories on Muslims, Arabs, and Southeast Asians that often has no connection to what is taking place is intended to maintain a siege mentality among members of the targeted group. It is hoped that constant external psychological pressure will lead to behavior modification in the targeted group. Since the human beings in general like to have a positive image of him or herself, and being confronted with a constant wave of negative constructs directed at core belief system, then the response can take a number of possibilities, and one of them produce a move toward change. The message from the negative campaign is that the problem is in what you believe and of who you associate with. And if you change it or completely leave those who you associate with, then you would be accepted as a normal and positive member of the American community. What we have here is a basic behavior modification program directed at Arabs, Muslims, and Southeast Asians, the goal of which is to bring about a complete change in the worldview and essential outlook of the targeted group. The legal cases, arrests of individuals, the expose of some secret groups training in a hamlet, and detailed accounts of money movements are all intended to keep the psychological pressure on the targeted community. Yes, a number of these cases are real, and the evidence warrant prosecution, but the overwhelming number of all others are nothing more than a psychological tool deployed for the specific purpose of containment. Another possible response of individuals facing such a psychological program might be to take a defensive, antagonistic position, thus resorting to retaliation and violence against the security agencies. In such instances, the individual or a group of individuals begins to see the state structure, security agencies, and the society in general as enemies that are out to get them by any means necessary. And as such, the only response would be to do unto others as they do unto you. In my opinion, this gives the security agencies the success they were seeking from the beginning, and further, can assert the correctness of the approach since they did discover a sleeper terrorist cell somewhere in Middle America. What we find in here is the success of the psychological program in producing two desired outcomes. One, in terms of behavior modification that leads to questioning one's own core beliefs or seeking an alternative to them altogether. And the second, possibly developing a more hostile attitude that can manifest in seeking revenge for what is seen as an attack on the community. In both cases, the security agencies can claim success for the psychological program, and the targeted group is left in utter destruction. The number of cases directly connected to 9/11 are limited to one or possibly two. However, the continuous stream of arrests and charges brought against Arabs, Muslims, and Southeast Asians are intended to maintain the psychological pressure. We have almost 1,000 that have been arrested immediately after 9/11. We have 266 other cases that we are dealing with in the court today. None of them have anything to do with the activities of 9/11. Zero. None. 266 cases and 1,000, we don't even have their names yet. It's 3 years since 9/11. We don't have their actual names from the arrest. Through a barrage of negative messages directed at the targeted communities, another benefit can be accrued in keeping possible allies at bay, which can help in the long run in isolating those deemed problematic from a security point of view. How to achieve an end game where the target is being pursued for a possible future crime and the only indication for violence is represented in the religious thought held by the individual or groups under scrutiny. External psychological warfare provides the needed tool to isolate and narrow the target field from millions to possibly hundreds of thousands, which if combined with other resources, then in the minds of security agencies, a possibility of elimination of the threat can be achieved. Now moving to the third element, harassment through by means of the law. One of the most powerful tools at the disposal of the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security is the legal system, which can be deployed as an instrument of control rather than basic adjudication of disputes between various parties, including the government. The legal system and law in general is born out of social conditions. Right? This is important to understand. The legal system and law in general is born out of social conditions and is highly influenced by them. When separate but equal was the law, the social conditions informed and provided the constructed boundaries for the legal arguments. Meaning it was the social conditions informed the legal arguments. Social condition change that make it possible for changing the arguments and bringing alternative arguments to the court, not the other way around. The same can be said about present-day conditions, where the judiciary has been more than ready to play along, providing the government needed legal cover for massive civil and human rights violations. And today on the good news that Torture Boy has been approved as our next attorney general. So next time you're arrested, it will be the torture chamber, considering he did not step back from his torture memo. Right? So he did not step in the hearings, he didn't. So now you have Gonzalez, Torture Boy, is our attorney general. Chertoff is the new Homeland Security chief. He's the one who authored the
Patriot Act, so we are in good hands, as we could say. During the early days of the 20th century, the Justice Department perfected the use of the legal system in a campaign of harassment and intimidation directed at anarchists and communists alike. Presently, we are witnessing once again the employment of the legal system in a well-designed harassment campaign directed at the leadership and activists in the Arab, Muslim, and Southeast Asian communities. In my own estimations, the goals of this campaign are many, but we can summarize them in the next 10 points. First, through the legal process, the FBI and the Homeland Security structures can immediately put the individuals and organizations out of business, since an arrest or a search warrant is intended to halt all activities carried out by the identified subject. When we examine the nonprofit sector and community-based organizations, we find that few individuals are responsible for keeping the group moving. And if they are suddenly removed from the scene, then the immediate outcome is a state of paralysis, which would take time to overcome. By targeting the leadership and the activist segment of the Arab, Muslim, and Southeast Asian communities, the FBI and the Homeland Security are essentially causing an internal collapse in many of the nonprofit organizations providing a variety of services. We must always be reminded of the harm and utter destruction visited upon the Native American and African American communities in a similar process that has been underway since the early days of this country. Now, if you just consider, the Black Panther Party was providing the morning breakfast program, Their removal from the scene removed that service from the community, and this is just on one small example. Second, by arresting, charging, or serving a search warrant, the FBI and the Homeland Security can immediately produce negative responses in the community toward those individuals and groups targeted. It is common for people to speak in the private, and they most likely say they must have done something, otherwise the FBI would not have come after them. Third, the legal process allows for a media frenzy to take place, and a wider negative campaign permeating the society relevant to the targeted individuals and groups. Often the media, and this is important, often the media was contacted before a given raid or arrest in such a way to guarantee a sensational coverage on the local channels. And if it is a big fish that is caught in the raid, then it is on the hour on the national news, Fox and CNN included. The intent of these prearranged media spectacles are to make the story of the arrest, raid, or search warrant as widely known as possible and help generate additional stories on the subject matter. As the saying goes, no one wants day-old news, and thus the breaking story creates frenzy among the media sharks, thus further helping achieve the psychological part of the campaign spoken about above. Fourth, through the arrest, raid, and searches, the FBI and the Homeland Security people are able to indirectly direct the agenda of activists and community organizations. This is very important. Immediately after the arrests, the targeted community, groups, or individuals would begin to mobilize for some type of a legal response, hire a lawyer, and organize a committee to handle the emerging situation, which might involve meetings face-to-face with the FBI or other security agencies. What is relevant for us is the actual directing of the group's or individual's agenda away from what they were doing to what the FBI and the Homeland Security people want them to do, i.e., follow the legal train to nowhere for the next 15 years. And instead of capacity building and fundraising for a future school or center, communities are instead overtaken by legal defense committee responsibility and trying to get more funds to hire a better lawyer and so forth. Fifth, another more damaging outcome of this approach is the real possibility for splits and fallouts among community members, who begin to point the fingers at each other and at those who were arrested, charged, raided, or searched. As the saying in Arabic goes, when a cow falls, then all the knives begin to cut through the meat, which means that the legal entanglement of a member or more of the community creates an internal feeding frenzy that leads often to self-destruction. In such a period, and with the first goal of infiltration already accomplished, the FBI and the Homeland Security might use the occasion to further existing differences into eventual splits and internal hostilities among members. 6. The legal process allows for new and less experienced people to emerge at the local community scene, and their initial period will be taken by figuring out who is who and what needs to be done at the time when the group is under siege. These are the moments that makes it possible for infiltrators to take positions of power and influence in the community. In some cases, we could see that the change of leadership is a welcome relief from an old and tired grouping that was in power for almost 30 years in some of these organizations. But the manner by which it's achieved should raise the alarm for everyone concerned, since change from the outside is not a healthy process in the US or in Iraq in the present context. 7, the legal process is very expensive. And if the community groups, who for the most part are first and second generation immigrants and possessing limited resources, are required to mount a large number of legal battles, then their financial position is greatly impacted. On a national level, the resources being committed for legal defense funds and hiring lawyers are putting a strain on the community and impacting school and community projects. In addition, the legal campaign could not have come at a worse time, where the economy is still at a downturn and many professional Arabs, Muslims, and Southeast Asians lost their jobs in the technology industry. Take, for example, Professor Samuel Aryan's case in Florida, where the retainer for the lawyer was upward of $650,000. And the figure for his lawsuit is expected to go over the $2.5 million by the end of this legal battle. Samuel Aryan is a professor at the University of South Florida. The government handed him 49-count indictment, and he is mounting a legal defense. The government had 30,000 hours of taped material on him, from speeches of conferences, from talks, from phone conversations. The government will translate the 30,000, and his lawyers have to also do their translation, because you should not trust the government and the prosecution in their translation. And therefore, he has to translate that material. And it's a 49-count indictment that allows foreign intelligence sources, Israeli sources, to be admitted into the court against him. He has not committed any crime whatsoever. He is in solitary confinement. He's been in solitary confinement for 3 years. Okay? And this is in a country where innocent until proven guilty. No, actually, they change it. Guilty until we say you're innocent has become the standard. We have 266 other legal cases that are on the docket right now. 260. The cheapest one will cost about $30,000. That's the cheapest one. 266. We have the Holy Land Foundation legal case in Texas. We have almost 16 cases in Chicago. We have cases in Ohio. We have cases in San Diego. We have cases in LA. We have cases here in San Francisco, all dealing with a variety of different issues. One person was arrested, and the only thing they had on him, that in his address book, he had a piece of paper that had an Islamic website on it. Is the website of Hizb al-Tahrir website, which is www.hizbaltahrir.org, And that was an enough evidence to keep him in solitary confinement and to go through proceedings of deportation under the premise that he is engaged or sympathetic to terrorists. Now, if anyone knows anything about Hizb al-Tahrir, Hizb al-Tahrir does not engage in any politics, period. Their position, just to understand what Hizb al-Tahrir is that we should not do anything until the Khalifa, the Muslim grand leader, is brought back, and once he is brought back, he tells us what to do. And until then, you should not do anything other than hope and work to get this leader back. How to get them, they don't tell you how. They have not built a mosque in this country. They have not built a school. They have not done anything. They don't engage in violence. You're not supposed to do anything until the Khalifa, the Caliph, returns. Right? So the argument was in court to deport him on the basis of a website being in his address book. Right? So you could see the type of legal cases. Now, any of these legal cases will have you have to hire a lawyer, you have to be in court, you have to mount a defense, you have to see what the government back and forth, because the government brings all this evidence around Hizb al-Tahrir, and you have to rebut it, and the lawyers, many of the lawyers, don't know what Hizb al-Tahrir is, let alone the website often is in Arabic, so they have to hire an expert that will read and give them a testimony, an expert witness about what the website is all about. So this is what you're dealing with in these legal cases. Another legal battle, the closing down of the Holy Land Foundation and freezing its assets, has already cost over $2 million in legal fees. And it's likely that the court proceedings will go until all the funds are drained by legal fees. In the Holy Land Foundation, the U.S. government froze about $5 million of the organization's funds. But in the legal process, the court allowed the lawyers to be compensated from these funds. Thus, it is in the best interest of the legal team to possibly prolong the case until all the monies are exhausted from the account. A number of areas in the U.S. have been hard hit by government legal campaigns, and it will take some time before they are able to recover both financially and organizationally to national levels. Eight, the legal harassment also leads to disrupting national networks built on years of trust and relations developed over generations. Often immigrant communities develop state and national networks based on the need to maintain some links with individuals and families from back home, which in due time begin to translate into alliances that serve as the bedrock for the emergence of political organizations. When legal battles develop, one of the outcomes of this is the disruption of these relations and the planting of seeds of doubt and mistrust among people who had long-standing relations for generations. Ninth, the regional and national patterns of organizations and groups begin to take more of a localized characteristic due to the preoccupation of legal battles governed by the specific associations and references to them. As such, Chicago, Arab, Muslims, and Southeast Asians begin to focus mainly on their own cities. Likewise, Dallas and New Jersey each will be preoccupied with their own set of legal cases that mitigate against further strengthening of national networks. Also connected to this is the need for resources begin to impact the level of openness to share and raise funds for other than one's own localized legal crisis. Tenth, through its legal harassment, the government can set in motion a great tide of fear, which begins to permeate every sector of the targeted community. Fear is a very important commodity, and its introduction as an instrument of control is a strategic one. Fearful people will accept a variety of initiatives that under normal conditions would be considered unthinkable. In the case of an immigrant who has limited knowledge of this society, fear tends to have a profound impact, and in some cases it could lead to a complete sense of hopelessness, which government agents can then use for their own interests. The legal tools are intended to bring about fear and provide an apt lesson to everyone in the Arab, Muslim, and Southeast Asian communities. If you dare to go out of line, then what awaits you is something 10 times worse than what your friend down the street got. And if you had a store or some money stashed away, then rest assured, we will take it away from you. Also, if you have some assets that you have been able to collect in your 10, 20, or 30 years of work in America, you might as well kiss all of them goodbye, for they will be taken away from you, and you will spend every penny attempting to clear your name. And good luck if you can. Lessons of a government which has the ability to use all powers at its disposal to achieve a set of goals, even be they unjust. The power of the government and the ever-increasing need to restrain it because it does have the absolute ability to render injustice and further making it to the norm without any recourse. The legal recourse is expensive and contingent upon the society's social attitudes and not divorced from it. In our current period, the courts have given all the needed leeway to the executive branch to overstep various significant parts of the Constitution, if they have ever read the Constitution, that is, and the high rate of public support makes it possible to affirm these steps. As such, the legal harassment by the government will continue, and we should expect a limited number of court victories in the future, but this ought not to confuse us away from understanding the structure that has been deployed and the 10 impacts highlighted above, which are already in motion. Next, the extra-legal force and violence. This was used heavily in the 60s and 70s, but not yet deployed domestically against the Arabs, Muslims, and Southeast Asians. However, one can argue that it has been used through the massive arrest and torture of individuals in many prisons across the United States. But this is something that we will expect, so we don't have yet extra legal force and violence committed against the community directly, but we should be watchful for this occurrence in the future. Finally, some positive developments in countering what is occurring. One is that there is an increasing resistance that is emerging in the Arab Muslim community, Arab Muslims and Southeast Asian community. We have an increasing resistance occurring. We have resistance occurring in communities in Chicago, in New York, in Texas. I spoke of $650,000 retainer to Sami Al-Aryan that was raised by the community on a national level. So there is at least an attempt to resist on the legal track as well as to engage in political process in developing a response to it. Second, coalitions across racial and ethnic lines. There's been tremendous coalitions that have emerged. One of the initial coalitions was a coalition with the Japanese community. The Japanese Citizens Defense League was in the forefront in coming close to the Muslim and Arab and Southeast Asian community initially, followed by the Asian Law Caucus, as well as many other ethnic communities that came to develop modes of coalition building for the long term. So these are positive elements in this current period. Also, there's a movement toward law. Many Arab Muslims and Southeast Asians for a long period of time were only studying the sciences, hard sciences. And we're witnessing a turn towards study of law. And I could mention in Bolt Law School, at least in the last semester, law class that I taught, we had 12 Muslim, Arab, and Southeast Asians taking the law class in there. So there's a change and a shift towards studying law, and this is seen being reflected nationally. And I joke with them on the side that this, you're turning to law at the particular time where you're going to have guaranteed employment for the next 20 years because we have so many cases, and you might get the chance to argue a case in front of the Supreme Court in a short period of time, while someone who have spent their 50 years studying and practicing law might not have that chance. So this is also a positive outcome. Fourth, there's linking domestic conditions to the global war on terrorism. They're beginning some discussions of the conditions of Arab Muslims and Southeast Asians domestically with the reflections of what is taking place globally on the war on terrorism. We have many violations that are occurring on an international level. Abu Ghraib is only one of them, and we already have evidence of coming of these shadowy prisons, prisoners outside international law where they are not recorded as prisoners. We have torture that has taken place in Jordan, in Egypt, in Pakistan. So we are subcontracting torture, where we could say that we do not approve of torture, but we have foreknowledge when we send people overseas to be tortured. And at least on a number of cases, we actually send the individuals from this country knowingly that they will be tortured and deported them under that premise. One of them is Maher Al-Arrar, who is from Canada, where the Canadian passed his name to the United States, where the United States then arrested him, deported him to Syria, knowing beforehand that they would lean on the Syrian authorities. For 7 months, Maher was tortured in prison in Syria, and then released back into the U.S. and then went to Canada. Just last week, the Canadians have admitted that they are the ones who passed his name to the United States, and the United States facilitated his transfer to Syria. We have another case of a person in Jordan, in the Jordanian prisons, then been tortured, American citizen. And then we have a third one, Ahmad Ali, who is currently in Saudi Arabia, being also under arrest, no crime, has not been charged whatsoever. The U.S. ambassador has not even went to see an American citizen in Saudi Arabia, and the conduct would be that the United States would actually go and see and check whether the individual has been violated. If you just reflect upon the case, do you remember the kid who was arrested in Southeast Asia, and don't remember the country, for possession of marijuana? Do you remember the full coverage news on him around the clock, because supposedly he was supposed to be flogged for the offense, and the United States was up in arms? Well, we could say that, one, he was white American, and I'm not here a person speaking about race, but if you're a white American, non-Muslim, non-Arab, non-Southeast Asians, and you're caught in any legal trouble outside the United States, then the whole machinery of the government will be behind you. But if you're Arab, Muslims, or Southeast Asians, black, Asian, or Native Americans, or Latinos, then hasta mañana, we'll see you tomorrow, and no one will come to check on you. So this is the reality of race politics and the racial matrix that we live under. But there is actually people that are making the link between domestic situation and the global war on terrorism. And then there is increased political involvement from the communities that have been historically staying outside the political process. Some of the involvement is problematic. I was cringing in ISNA's convention this last year because there was a very huge decked out booth with Muslims for Bush. And it was actually one person with three, with his family members, and this is basically they donated money to Bush. So political involvement, there are, even though that we have a large involvement, some of the involvement is something that have to be what you call looked upon twice. But there is positive aspect of it in terms of this involvement. So thank you for listening, and I'll be more than happy to answer any and all of your questions at this particular time.